and words are thoughts. And that's what we talk about all weekend, isn't it? This is Buddha's expertise, how the mind works and how to transform it. We can mold this mind into any shape we like. As Lama Zopa Rinpoche says, and we're not talking about our brain cells, we're talking about our thoughts. It's as simple as that. So the Buddha would say, as we've been talking, every thought kind of like gets stuck in there, goes in there and programs the mind, shapes the mind. The mind is thoughts, and whatever goes in is shaped by that. It's sort of reasonable. So these thoughts that we're going to say in Tibetan, the first two lines are like expressing for those of us who figure we are already Buddhists, as reminding us, kind of reiterating our reliance on the Buddha, his teachings and so on. And the second two lines can be for all of us. It's expressing an altruistic kind of reason for being here together to listen to these ideas, Buddha's views of the universe, Buddha's views of happiness, suffering, reality, people, things. You know, that's what he deals with. So that we can take some tools. That's the point. It's got to be practical, not just entertaining. I'm happy I make you laugh, but it's meant to be, you know, tools. So laughingly take the tools away. So the tools are meant to be for what? To help us shape this marvelous mind of ours into its amazing potential, according to the Buddha. So in turn, we can help others, because we all live in this insane asylum together. And as the Bodhisattvas would say, if I don't do it, who will? It's a sense of responsibility that we try to cultivate. And we'll talk more about that today. Okay. Sangye charang soke chognam la jang cho badu dagni kyab suchi dagi chonyen gipe sonam ki drola penchir sangye dropa shok Sangye charang soke chognam la jang cho badu dagni kyab suchi dagi chonyen gipe sonam ki drola penchir sangye dropa shok Sangye chadang soke chok namla chang cho badu dagni kyab suchi dagi chonyen gipe sonam ki drola penchir sangye dropa shok. And like yesterday too, let's make an offering to the Buddha as if the Buddha were here himself, as a request for the teachings, you know. Very auspicious to do that. So we just use our imagination, we visualize all the contents of the universe. Well, if you know the contents of the universe according to Buddha's cosmology, which is, you know, they teach us that the sky is blue because it reflects off lapis lazuli. You didn't learn that, did you? So anyway, if you know that view of the universe with holy cows and ladies and all this business, you don't know that one, don't worry. Just think of the contents of this universe, all the lovely contents of Harrods and the jewels and the food and the diamonds and the delicious music and these things. Really, just visualizing all the objects of the universe that make beings happy, piling them up, an offering to the Buddha as a request. Saji perki jogshing metog Tram ri rab ling ji ni de gyen pa di sangge jing du mik te ur wa gi dro kon nam dag jing la che pa shok. Now imagine Buddha delightedly accepts. Idam guru ratna mandala kam niryatayami. So talking about making you laugh, did I tell you, when I was living in London, especially in the 80s, the number of people who thought I was Ronnie Corbett. I swear. One taxi at night, a taxi driver, he was about 50 yards away, and he drove up and he said, "Oh my God, I thought you were Ronnie Corbett." These two little short, perky people. You can see the likeness, can't you? I know one time in Sydney, I was at a hospice giving a hospice conference. These wonderful doctors and nurses, and apparently they get these actors to role play to help people learn how to deal with dying people, whatever. And so one of these actresses, I gave a little talk, and she was sitting there thinking, "My God, she reminds me of Ronnie Corbett." So what can I say? Anyway, there you go. So, all right. What I wanted to do today, this morning, because we talked yesterday about karma, about the mind, giving some kind of, you know, background to this business that is the title of the talk, how to purify karma. And in particular, this particular practice, and then we talked about that before we finished, this purification process. So I want to lead you through the meditation. But before we do that, I want to summarize, you know. So maybe some of you weren't here yesterday. Is that true? Okay. Well, it's hard to summarize 6 hours of talk, but I can try. So just to remind us, okay, traditionally when they give the teachings in Tibet, it's interesting, they will give it one teaching, long. Then the next day they'll give it a summary, shorter, and then the next day another summary, shorter. They give it three times. And it's really helpful. We can hear that, you know. Repeat, remind. So, okay, what did we talk about yesterday? Well, the essence of it is the essence of Buddha's approach, you know. As we were saying, Buddhism basically, to think about the biggest picture point of view, what Buddha was saying, Buddhism is a worldview, basically. People mightn't think of it this way. We don't think of it that like this. We would think of religion as a worldview, but essentially it is, you know. Buddhism is a way, is Buddha's view, Buddha's approach, Buddha's way of seeing the universe. And, of course, he's not like a creator. He's not created anything. Therefore, it's not to be merely believed. This one I cannot stress enough. I cannot stress this one enough. Because we're so addicted to the view, because that's our world, and that's not criticism, that religion equals creator, therefore belief. This is the logic. But this is not the Buddha's view. Even though we know these words, it's hard to hear it. Buddha was a regular guy. You know, he probably cheated on his wife. Well, he didn't need to. He had a harem, so he was all right, you know. But, I mean, a regular person who, through his own enormously hard work, molded his mind into the mind of a Buddha, an enlightened being. So that means a consciousness, a mind, remember, not physical, doesn't come from God or Buddha, doesn't come from mummy, daddy, isn't your brain, goes to more subtle levels, is beginningless, is endless, and has this infinite potential. The Buddha says every sentient being, every living being has this potential to perfect their mind. So it's like I keep saying, it's a very different way we talk in either our materialist view or indeed our Christian or Muslim views, you know. So it's Buddha's view. So there's the simplest, best, easiest way to take Buddhism, or anything for that matter, is to listen to it with an open mind. And the reason you're listening is because you've chosen to listen. I mean, this is a really crucial point, because you're the boss here. Like I keep repeating, we are the boss, not Buddha. So you have decided you'd like to hear about Buddhism. And then some of you continue to hear it and then decide to take it on board, which means basically you're taking it on board as your working hypothesis. This is exactly the correct, perfect approach. They'd say in Buddhism, they didn't use those phrases, you know. You don't hear Buddha saying, take it as your working hypothesis. He didn't say that concept. You know, he said, check it out. The way they use the analogy in Buddha's teachings, he talks the analogy as you would check gold. Well, you know, we don't talk that way. We don't have gold. But you get the idea. You don't just swallow it whole. You don't believe whatever you hear. This is so important. Now, so Buddhism is this worldview. It's a view of the universe. So essentially, it's about mind. That's Buddha's expertise. As we've been talking, everything comes from the mind. When we hear that with a materialist concept in our head, it seems bizarre, because we think mind equals brain. But, you know, we've got to change our definitions here, you know. So it's Buddha's observation, and his own observation, it wasn't revealed to him. There's no such concept of a typical religious one of its revelation coming from on high. That's how we think of this information, as coming from on high. That's in its nature mystical, therefore in its nature is not knowable by me, therefore is to be believed in. This is not the concept here. And this is why I keep saying it, although it sounds funny to us, like I'm being cute or something, that it's more like Einstein. You know, if I were Einstein here, I would be telling you about my own direct observations. You know that. You know I didn't have a dream about it yesterday. You know it wasn't revealed to me in a vision. You know I'm not making a whole bunch of stuff up. You know I've done my work and I'm content and I think I'm right. I would not open my mouth until I know I'm right. That's any decent scientist would say that, you know. But we don't think that way in spiritual. We think, oh, I have a dream, yes, I can write a whole book about it. The number of Westerners who write books about Buddhism, you know. I mean, in the Tibetan monastic university system, since you're a kid, you listen to it, you study it, you memorize it, for God's sake, you debate on it until it becomes incredibly logical for you. You would never dare even open your mouth about a word until you're asked. It's a very marvelous system, actually. You know, let's say we're at the monastery together, and you're a little kid, And now the nuns are doing the same, you know, especially since Lama Yeshe, he started the amazing nunnery in 79 in Kathmandu, and there's now 300 nuns more than at Kopan Monastery studying the same program. Actually, one Lama told us that a few centuries ago in Tibet, because there were never really fully ordained nuns in Tibet, but some bunch of nuns were studying and doing really well at it. And some of the monks down the road got so jealous, they started to write special texts that the nuns didn't know about so they could beat them in debate, you know. So it was a nice story. Anyway, you go to the monastery, you're a little kid, you join the monastery, then you listen, you have your little teacher, and you start learning all the texts and memorizing, then you start going to classes, and you learn things. And you go to, and the night you go to the debate yard, that's like their football. That's their best activity in the monastery is the debate yard. It's intense. It's amazing. It's like the best entertainment in the whole world. It's like verbal karate, you know, it really is. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary system where they hone their minds to an incredible degree in order to get rid of the nonsense, the delusions, that believe in fantasies, like we talked yesterday, to get some kind of clarity, some kind of wisdom, you know. And so these, you know, if you're a little kid and you look around, you say, oh, I like that one over there. Let's say you're a monk in the monastery. You say, I like that one. And then you go to him eventually, to his room, prostrate 3 times, and say, please, will you teach me? So that's how you become a teacher. That's how you open your mouth. You only open your mouth or dare to write a text if someone asks you, which is an incredible system. But here, us, God, one dream and off we go, publishing, you know, like we're an expert. And because it's spiritual, we don't think we have to prove anything. That's what's so shocking. This is what, like, beyond irresponsible. We call it being creative. We call it using fantasies, you know. It's kind of hideous, really. Misleading people. It's just terrible. Anyway, Buddha was this regular guy who, through this hard work coming out of the Hindu tradition, that created these marvelous meditation techniques in their investigation of the nature of self. And then Buddha diverges in his own direction. So since that time, Buddhism, you know. So it's his findings. Whatever is Buddhism, and as long as it's valid, and that's for you to check up, like we were talking yesterday, it's from Buddha's mind. It's his own, it's like Einstein, you know. It's his findings. And then Einstein, he's happy. He's, you know, if I were Einstein, I'm not going to bully you into believing what I say. That would be silly. What good is it to believe something, you know? Oh, yeah, I believe in mathematics. What's it mean? Oh, I don't know. What good is that? No wonder you live in fear. So Buddha says you've got to prove it yourself. That means take it on board as your hypothesis first. Intellectual, that's where we start. And then you start to work with it. And each step of the way, you do two things. You experience it as yours, which means you're verifying it as true. Step by step, you know. That's the approach. That's the best approach. That is the approach. The only way to internalize anything. And we call it learning. It's so simple. We call it learning music, learning Chinese, learning violin, learning cooking. You listen, you think about it, you put it together, it's coherent intellectually, and then you experience it. This is exactly what you're doing here. No different. Okay, so Buddha's saying we have this mind. It's the central player in the universe. Trillions of minds, Buddha says. Not physical. Not coming from mummy or daddy. Not coming from a creator. Not starting out of nowhere. Therefore beginningless and endless. And have this potential, is the point. This tradition here, the Mahayana Buddhist view, is that every single mind necessarily possesses Buddha nature, possesses the innate potential to be perfected. And so, like we mentioned yesterday, the word Sangye, the Tibetan word for the Sanskrit word Buddha, the first syllable implies the complete eradication of all the neuroses, and the second syllable implies the complete development of all the goodness, simply speaking. And like we talked quite, you know, yesterday, I won't lead the meditation yet, have to talk more, okay? So we'll lead it soon. So as we talked yesterday, but didn't go into it quite enough, which we'll do now, okay? Into the model of the mind, Buddhist psychological model of the mind, how it functions. The words are incredibly familiar. Nothing cosmic, nothing special. There's nothing complicated, like you've got to look up dictionaries for definitions. You know, we look into the psychiatric, you know, manuals. There are volumes of them. Every day, new mental illnesses that we're coming up with in our culture. In Buddhism, it hasn't changed in 2,500 years, you know. So like we said, the mental model, the model of the mind for Buddha. Okay, just remember, if it's true, I have this potential to perfect my mind, to mold it into this perfect shape, to be full of bliss and clarity and love and compassion and wisdom and free utterly of the neuroses. If it's true, then I better know what the neuroses are and how they function, because they're the cause of suffering, and I better know how to distinguish them from the stuff that's at the core of my being, simply speaking, which is the goodness. Simply speaking, I better know how to distinguish. I've got to use my noggin. So first you start intellectually. So let's look at the model of the mind again, remember from yesterday. So the mental, we've got sensory consciousness and we have mental consciousness. Well, mental consciousness is where the workshop is, as Lama Zopa says. Divide, the contents of our mind are divided into three categories. Positive states of mind, beneficial, useful, appropriate, you know, reasonable, that are the source of my happiness, and therefore the source of my doing nice things to other people. Negative states of mind, and these are technical terms, remember, not moralistic. The negative ones, neurotic ones, delusional ones, disturbing ones, that are the source of my pain, the source of my torment, and the source of why I harm others. Now this is the across the board, this is how it is, Buddha says, and this is not just humans, this is all living beings, you know, all the monkeys, all the dogs, all the giraffes, all the ants, all the fish, same model of the mind, surprisingly. And then, of course, as we discussed yesterday, there's this third category called neutral, which means neither negative nor positive. It's not some kind of abstract idea, but it's this, like the mechanics of the mind, not the brain, the mind, thoughts, that enable us to function properly, that in their nature are neither negative nor positive, don't have those characteristics, but are crucial nevertheless. So if you're a good sniper, you need really good mindfulness, you need really good awareness, you need really good concentration, you need really good recognition, these many states of mind, whether you're a meditator or a murderer, you need them to do it properly. So in that sense, they're not good or bad, but they're useful. Because the way Buddhism talks, this model, virtuous and non-virtuous have a very specific meaning, you know? And again, not moralistic. We don't talk this way in the West because we're very fearful of starting to bring ethics into it because it sounds like religion to us. And we think, you know, well, you know, but this is the fundamentals in Buddhism, the fundamentals, and logically so. Like we talked yesterday, it's like this too is a natural law. So the Buddha would say that the negative ones are the source of our suffering. And the actions we do with our body and speech, which basically are the servants of our mind, which cause others to suffer, are the ones that leave imprints in the mind that cause us to suffer now and in the future. I mean, the process itself of this karma business is highly complex. But again, remember, Buddha says it's a natural law. There's no one up there punishing or rewarding. There is no concept like this in Buddhism. And we have to keep saying this because in us, instinctively, we don't have to have been brought up a Christian or something to have the instinctive view, the dualistic view of punishment and reward. It's something primordial within us. It's a philosophical position that we've all got, the Buddha says, due to these neuroses in the mind. There's positions that our mind has naturally. You don't have to be taught by your Catholic mum or your Jewish mum to get guilty. It's natural response having these delusions. The natural response of this dualistic view of, you know, if you're a good girl, you want people to see you're a good girl. Like, you know, mummy says do this. Oh, mummy, I did it. I'm a good girl, aren't I, mummy? And if she doesn't say I'm a good girl, I'm devastated. And then if I didn't do what she said and I was naughty, I really hope that I get away with it and she doesn't see me. This is our view of morality across the board. No one teaches us this. It's spontaneous. And it's delusional. So for the Buddha, as we're talking, morality and ethics are something fundamental. He would say, you know, if you're, like I said yesterday, if you're a Catholic, or I was taught as a Catholic, no, I remember I quote, my Jesuit priest friend, I asked him, what is a sin by definition? And this is the point. It is, by definition, an action going against the will of God, which implies the boss, God, a creator, who makes me, makes the laws of morality, makes the universe. So necessarily is to be obeyed. And I'm not complaining about that. Buddha would argue with it and says it's not like that. But that's okay. We can all think what we like. It's up to us. And if you do have that view, then you need to believe in God and you need to mind your own business and back off and let him do his job and believe in him totally. Really, this is really true, but it's a scary thought that it's all God's will. This is perfect. It's the perfect view if you're a Christian. The perfect view. But that's shocking to most Christians, you know. Most Muslims, no doubt. Most Jews as well. We rant and rave and complain about God. Well, you can't have it both ways, you know. If you believe in God, back off and mind your own business. You can't have it both ways. You really can't. You can't question God if you have that view. It's very powerful. I can't imagine. It's an incredibly blissful view. I remember watching, that one of those planes that fell into the ocean recently, Air Asia one in Malaysia, and they're all Muslims, and you saw in the newspaper, and you saw the faces of the people, the parents and everybody, absolutely distraught with pain because their babies and their husbands and wives had died, you know. But one family, one couple, You saw their face. They were blissful. They were asked, how do you feel about your daughter drowning? She belongs to God. We don't mind. He has now taken her back. They were happy. Well, that's because of their view. And this is the point we're making yesterday, and hear it again. What Buddha's saying effectively is every single thing that goes on in this mind of ours is the source of whether we're happy or suffering. That's what Buddha means by suffering and happiness come from the mind. Literally, whatever, though it proves it, that point. Their philosophical position, their view was that she belonged to God. They had faith in God. Therefore, it's God's will. Who are they to complain? Don't think that's bad. I think that's blissful. That's unbelievable. Look at them. That's the cause of happiness for them. Don't criticize that. That's absolutely incredible. So, the point the Buddha's making, he would argue and say a creator is a misconception. He would say that. He gives his reasons. And he's allowed to say that. But even that is proving the point. Even if you can believe in something that's not true, and it can make you happy. Well, I think good enough, you know, God. I mean, believe in things that aren't true and be miserable, that's ridiculous. So anyway, the Buddha, I rave on a bit? Are we communicating here or not? Thank you very much. Okay. I'm trying to stay focused, okay. Okay, so Buddha's view is, this is one of the implications, and I think this is just amazing. And this really helps us, our minds settle. Whatever goes on in any mind, the mind of a dog, the mind of an ant, the mind of a giraffe, the mind of a human, the mind of a pedophile, the mind of Hitler, the mind of your mummy. Whatever goes on in the mind here, the thoughts, meaning all the constructs, all the elaborate conceptual constructions. This is the point. But what Buddha's saying is, divided into these three categories, positive, negative, propelled by all these practical parts of the mind, concentration, intelligence, this, that, all the bits, or concentration, mindfulness, all these other bits and pieces that aren't in their nature virtuous or non-virtuous. This is the source of my happiness and suffering. And the Buddha's point is this. There are some, and they're all viewpoints. In other words, they're all viewpoints. This is a cup. That's a viewpoint. It's a viewpoint. This is a thermos. That's a viewpoint. So is, this is a red cup. That's also a viewpoint. So we can discuss quite reasonably at a conventional level, and we'll talk about emptiness today, okay? We can discuss conventionally that we've all, by agreement, we've all signed the contract that says that's a white cup. We've all defined what white means. We've all defined what cup means. We've ticked all the boxes. We all shake hands. We agree conventionally that's a white cup. And that's the only reason it's a white cup, because we've called it a white cup. We've made it up. It's not white cup from its own side. It's not white cup coming from God. It's not a belief system, it's a view we have created. But we can say, therefore, it's a correct viewpoint. Red cup is a viewpoint, but it ain't correct, baby. And this is Buddha's point. This is his essential, amazing, marvelous point about the negative states of mind, known also as disturbing emotions. That we can prove. Check the last time you were jealous. You don't go, wow, Rabina, I was jealous yesterday, and it was just great. We do not. Very simple. We know it's heartbreaking. Depression, anger, we know the words upside down and back to front. They've got the characteristic of being disturbing. That we can see. But they have the characteristic of being a viewpoint that isn't correct. This is a shocking idea to us. Anger's a viewpoint. And it's not correct. It's inaccurate. It's like saying that's a red cup. And that's the approach. That's the wisdom approach to the teachings, you know. And this is so fascinating. Because Buddha's deal is, where he's heading with all his information, is what's real and what isn't. And why is he interested in what's real? Not just to be some clever philosopher who passes his exams, which is how we think about it in the West. Being a genius scientist, a genius mathematician, you know, you still go home and get depressed. So in the end, so for the Buddha, in the end, what goes on in here and how we behave in our life, if they don't come together and aren't coherent and complementary, there's something severely wrong. We're schizophrenic. Having a clever head but a miserable heart, that's mental illness. And that's what he says. So that's where wisdom, we think wisdom, if you go to become a physicist, you've got a very wise person. But you can still be neurotic. So if your wisdom, for the Buddha, if your wisdom doesn't inform your actual life, your actual being, then there's something missing from it. And this is the point. Like there's this, you know, I mean, this analogy, Buddhism says a bird needs two wings, wisdom and compassion. Yesterday we have been talking about the wisdom wing, what we have to do on ourselves to put ourselves together, to recognize ourselves, to recognize suffering, to be vomiting at the thought of suffering, sick of it, understand the causes of it, and then decide to do something about it. This is the method that brings us. This is the method that molds us into this marvelous person, the person we want to become. The person we are innately, but we kind of got to unpack, you know. This is the wisdom wing. Then you're qualified to help others do the same. This is the idea. So wisdom is not some abstract idea, intellectual idea. It's a profound experiential thing for the Buddha. Because he's saying the extent to which our minds are caught up in these neuroses, starting, like we said, with this primordial mistake of ego grasping, which we'll go into today, on the basis of which is this, in the, which is this bottomless sense, this primordial neurotic sense of a concrete, solid, independent, real, pointable, findable, bereft, lonely, panic-stricken me, which is in the nature of fear, which gives rise to this profound, primordial neediness to get what that me wants, which gives rise to the panic attack of anger and jealousy, anger and aversion when it doesn't get what it wants, which is 1,000 times a day, which gives rise to the other dramas, you know, the anger, the aggression, the arrogance, and the rest. This is hierarchy in these neurotic states of mind. For the Buddha, they are states of mind, they are viewpoints, but they happen to be, you know, causing us to live in la-la land. And that, oddly enough for us, which is not how we think, that is why they are the cause of suffering. We're believing in things that don't exist. This is what Buddha says. This is the source of suffering. So getting wisdom in Buddhism is the method for getting happy. It's the method for getting happy. And that, in other words, the extent to which we are caught up in these neuroses is the extent to which we are living in la-la land, therefore suffering. And the extent to which we're caught, we remove these, lessen these, weaken these, and therefore allow to reveal more and more clearly the natural stuff within us, which is virtue. And don't just take this as some kind of belief system. We can logically prove it. It must be able to be logically proved. That's the point with Buddhism. If it can't be, it doesn't exist. This is the Buddha's view. If your mind can't sort it out, it doesn't exist. So as we lessen the neuroses, we lessen fear, we lessen suffering, we lessen delusion, we grow goodness and contentment and joy and bliss and compassion and kindness and empathy and interconnectedness. It's like hardly rocket science. And it's a doable job, Buddha says, by all sentient beings. You mightn't have the conditions. He would suggest a worm has this potential because it's a sentient being, but it as a worm, it doesn't have all the conditions. It can't access its goodness in its poor little worm mind, you know? But fortunately, as a human, we can if we work hard. This is what Buddha's saying. So let's look more at the contents of this mind of ours. Let's look more at the difference between the positive and the negative states, because again, these are technical terms. It's very precise. The precision and clarity that we know we need to learn cooking even, forget about physics, is the same. Precision and clarity the Buddha demands we use to understand our mind. Therefore, mold it into the shape we want. It's not some hit and miss, hippy trippy thing, you know, which is how we think is spiritual. So, okay, these negative states, again, like this is hierarchy. Ego grasping, the colloquial term for this fundamental delusion in Tibetan, ma rigpa, unawareness. Or ignorance. But it's got, like all these words in this tradition, in this system, like any proper system, has its definitions. Like I always mention the word flat. If you live in London, you live in a flat. If you've got no geometry, the table's flat. If you play music, you play B flat. It's the same word, but we all know in that system it means something different. So when we hear the word here, love, compassion, attachment, don't use your definition. It might be similar to Buddha's, but it might not be. So don't assume it's the same because you hear the word. It's really important. So you hear the word ignorance, oh yeah, ignorance, okay. It's got a specific definition here. It's the name for this root delusion, as they call it. So okay, what's its function? Well, it's like double trouble, this ignorance. Ignorance, regular ignorance is easy to fix. You know, if I say that's a red cup, and I just got the light was wrong, you know? And you point out that it's a white cup. I go, oh, you're right. Well, you just fixed my ignorance, didn't you? Now I know what it is. It's a white cup. Easy to fix. But the trouble is this, the other aspect of this ignorance, which is why it is so hard to change, which is why to work on our minds is like ripping off our skin. Because we've got, this ignorance has this extra function that Buddha would say we've had for eons, that we're totally addicted to, that's made up its own ridiculous story, that's completely opposite to the truth. So we've convinced ourselves that white is red, in other words. And so we are convinced, we're caught up in it, we believe in it, we're obsessed with it, we're attached to it, and anybody who dares to agree, disagree, will have a mental breakdown. That ignorance is harder to move. And that's the function here of this ignorance. This marigpa, this ignorance, this self-grasping, as it's known colloquially, which is such a great, you know, accurate phrase. This self-grasping, this ego-grasping, primordial, way beyond what we would think of as a concept. Remember we talked yesterday and said when you study the model of the mind in Buddhism, you study the epistemological model, which is the way the mind works, conception, perception, and it's highly complex and very fascinating. But you study the psychological model, which is what we're discussing here, the contents, the states of mind themselves. So in the epistemological model, you understand that the mental consciousness functions at least, first of all, in two ways, and you divide up all those into many different ways. And that's conception and perception. We all use the word perception, but it's got a very specific definition here. And perception is necessarily, in the mental consciousness, is a very refined level of mind that you can only access once you've got very deep single-pointed concentration that is able to cognize things non-conceptually. Now, this is abstract for us. Completely abstract, you know. So forget perception. We're talking here at the level of conception. So everything in our daily lives that we experience, for us in our world, we would say conceptions are here and emotions are here. For Buddha, they're all conceptions. So once we get that concept, and we discussed it yesterday, we'll do more now, we really are on track with understanding Buddha psychology. We've really got it right, you know. Because like we showed yesterday, briefly, and we'll talk more now, if they're all conceptions, and the neurotic ones, the deluded ones, the disturbing ones are misconceptions, then you can change a misconception like we did yesterday. We just proved it, you know. You can remove a misconception from the mind by seeing the truth. When you tell me, when I can convince it's a white cup because I can see the truth, that removed forever from my mind the misconception of red cup. Well, that's how you get enlightened. If we understand this idea that all these neuroses, all the disturbing emotions, all these dramas, that we can see the world, the evidence of them, they're actually misconceptions. It almost sounds hilarious to think that. We think of them as deeply disturbing, insane, you know, emotions, and there is that component. But the Buddhist view, the more, like we talked yesterday, the more we get some focus, the more concentration, based upon the fundamental junior school level of controlling your body and speech, don't run around jumping on the wrong people and killing and lying and stealing, and stuffing 7 pieces of cake in your mouth, control your body and speech, which gives you the ability to start to see your mind, then you learn some concentration, then you step out of the mess, and then you can begin to focus based on understanding Buddha's model, and you can then begin to identify the contents of your mind and start to work on them, deconstruct and reconstruct. It's an immensely difficult job. Technically not complicated. Technically an easy job to lay out, but enormously difficult only because we're addicted to the lies, that's all. That's the reason. And this is this double trouble, this ignorance one. It not only does this ignorance cause us not to know how things exist ultimately, finally, but we believed in the exact opposite. And then again, just briefly, here we'll go to more to this one now. So I'm talking about emptiness. Everything in the teachings leads us to this one, okay? But on the basis of this ego grasping, like we said in this hierarchy of these neuroses, the primordial one is the assumption of the self, the neurotic self, the assumption of it that drives everything, even causes to be reborn. which then gives rise to the main one, which is effectively the one we have day-to-day life, that again is so primordial we hardly even properly understand it. And it's simply called attachment, but it's multifaceted, like I said, you know, which is essentially this craving, neurotic, constant, continuous, minute by minute, millisecond by millisecond, frantic neediness to get what that assumed I wants. Every millisecond. And the millisecond it doesn't get what it wants, which is 1,000 times a day. You drop something. What do? You get annoyed, don't you? That's called anger. Because why? Because your attachment wants everything to be nice. You don't think you're attached to not dropping something, but there's an assumption that when something that attachment doesn't want, which is the nice things, happens, then you get upset. That's called, it's a mild version of anger. Anger is a response when attachment doesn't get what it wants. But we have these nice, polite words, frustrated, annoyed, irritated, upset. We just think, oh, that's normal. No, they're versions of aversion, which is the bare-bones state of mind that informs anger. And it's the response when attachment doesn't get what it wants, which is every millisecond frantically wanting. And to even begin to see that is pretty profound. These two, effectively, are the main cause of most suffering on this earth. This sounds beyond insane if you take on board the idea of all the volumes of psychiatric mental illnesses. Buddha's saying these are the main problem. It sounds almost too simplistic. We're almost embarrassed to say it. But this is Buddhist psychology, so it's up to us to look into it, you know. So, okay. So attachment, already, if we can harness that one in this daily life, we'd be pretty amazing people. then it gives us space to get to the root one. The very concept of the I in the first place. So let's look at this. Let's look at this one. Half the trouble with us looking into this one, if we could have even been studying this stuff for years, and we still say, oh, just don't understand emptiness, it's too hard for me, don't get it. It's half the time the problem is because we haven't got our head around the way they use the words. You know? So let's just look at the words first. Get our head around how they use the words. So we know from the teachings, you read, you know, in order to stop samsara, we have to realize emptiness. We must have read that 1,000 times in all the Buddhist literature. And we just go blank. Well, first, because what's samsara mean? We have this vague notion that samsara is some sexy place where you're allowed to have sex and drugs, that you have to give up to go to boring old nirvana. That is how we think, is it not? Very simplistic. Well, it's got nothing, they're not places. Samsara is a word that Buddha uses. It can be used to refer to the cycling of rebirth, or more fundamentally, more psychologically, it's referring to simply being caught up in the neuroses. In that sense, we are in samsara. It's a term used to refer to being caught up in the delusions. We don't use the word like that. So as long as we know it means that, we will interpret it correctly. Instead of just visualizing that samsara is where you're, you know, like I said, that you feel guilty. Oh, I've got to go to nirvana. Oh, God, you know. Nirvana is not a place like heaven. It's another word for a different state of being. Honestly, they are names simply you can give to being certain states of mind. Not just moment by moment, but a goal. In other words, nirvana is what you've achieved when you followed the steps that Buddha lays out of removing the neuroses from your mind, having realized emptiness, quote unquote, which we'll talk about, so that now only the virtues are there. That's what nirvana means. It's called cessation of suffering. These are states of mind. They're psychological things, and they imply progression and hard work, not places where you're sent if you're good or, you know, like that. So what's emptiness? The biggest question, what's emptiness? We just get, oh, emptiness. Well, we've got to get used to the words, you know. Once we get head around this, it's so much easier, you know. So let's just talk about the word. Okay, if I look in my cup, I go, oops, my cup is empty. What do we know very well it means empty of tea, because we get used to that language, don't we? We know it means tea. We don't mean elephants or something, you know. Oh, we just mean my cup is empty of tea. If you look in the room, you go, oh, Rabina, the room's empty. We know it might be full of furniture, but we mean it's empty of people. So we understand the concept, something's empty. So something that does exist is empty of something else, isn't it? That's how we talk, isn't it? It's not complicated. It's not complicated. We talk like that. Well, Buddha also talks like that. So don't make the word more fancy. It's not a religious word in its nature. So what he says is, everything that exists is empty, inherent existence. Okay, so obviously we've got to work out what everything exists means. But we've got to work out what inherent existence means, don't we? That's all. Work it out what it means. Get the definition. And then you know that whatever exists doesn't have that. It's not complicated. As a concept, we're very clever people. We're geniuses intellectually. It just means that what does exist lacks a certain type of existence. So get your head around that. You've got to learn it. We don't think like this every day. But it means there is something that does exist. It just says whatever does exist is empty of a certain way of existing. It's called inherent existence. Well, never mind that for a second, okay? We'll look into what that means in a minute. Obviously, to get it, you've got to understand what it means. Then you can begin to investigate the meaning. Like if I say my cup's empty of tea and you know what tea is, you've got to first learn what tea is to know what's empty of tea, don't you? So we've just got to be practical and learn the definitions. But we just make them holy. And we think it's some revelation will come, it'll sort of like a blinding flash and I'll get emptiness. I mean, that's how we think. It's so embarrassingly stupid, you know? Just got to learn the words, please. We all live at the level of words, so we use words. So all Buddha's saying is that everything that exists is empty of inherent existence. That's it. That's the summary. It's like saying E equals MC squared. Oh, I can say that. Well, good, you start saying it, but this is going to take you 20 years to learn it, isn't it? You've got to start with 1 plus 1 is 2, and then you go through the process to start putting meat on the bones. Same here. Same here. So then, okay, so let's look first. So first of all, what's the point of that? Who cares? So, Buddha's saying, all right, okay. Sorry. Okay. Buddha's saying everything that exists, including the self, is empty of inherent existence. So then you go, well, that's interesting, Buddha. What are you telling me for? That's the point. Why are you telling me this? If I say to you, this cup is empty of being red. We don't talk that way, but you can get it, can't you? Would you agree this cup is empty of being red? Because empty means lacking, you know? Oh, my cup lacks tea. So if I say to you, this cup is empty of being red, who would that be useful to? Which person would it be that information is useful to? Pardon? Say it. Who said that? Whose mouth spoke? Thank you. Enough. He got it right. That's the answer. So if you already know this is white, why would I tell you it's not red? I'm just kind of completely boring. You know the truth, don't you? But if you think it's red, if you're colorblind and you think it's red, then the information is useful to you. First, Rabina, this cup is not red. Oh, really? So it's relevant information for the person who thinks it's red. Can you hear that? So Buddha says, listen, you people, everything that exists, including yourself, is empty of being self-existent. So he must be telling us that because he has observed that we think we exist inherently. Can you hear this point? So then we go, oh, what's that mean? So that's, of course, we've got to work out what it means. So this is exactly what he's saying the function of this ego grasping is. Its mistake is to think that I and everything else exists inherently. Don't worry about the meaning yet. We'll go into the meaning in a minute. We're getting our head around the construct. Are we communicating here? So the only reason he wants us to realize that everything that exists doesn't exist inherently is because we think things exist inherently. And then you've got to say to him, well, what's the problem with that, mate? Why does it matter if I see things as inherent? And now we get to the point. He says, well, sweetheart, that's why you suffer. It's okay, we don't see that. It's awfully abstract. It's kind of, even you hear it, you go, who cares? But this is his finding. This is his final finding. This is his final finding. That this ignorance, its job is to believe in primordially and totally and completely that there is in here somewhere an inherent self. So we still haven't looked at what it means yet, but don't worry, we will go there. Get our head around the concept first. So then, because we're taking it as our hypothesis, because it certainly doesn't seem evident to us, we have to start unpacking it all and learning the definition of inherent existence and learning what it means empty and learning what it means self and learning even what it means what exists. Put all these bits and pieces together so we can begin to be coherent in our talking and our thinking. So we can start to unpack it and see what he says till eventually in meditation the penny drops and we see the truth of it. Are we communicating? Okay. So, like I said before, all the neuroses have one key characteristic. They embellish the truth. They embellish what's there. So, in other words, there is something. Lama Zopa says, when we've, quote unquote, realized emptiness, when we have seen experientially in the subtlest level of our mind with direct perception that it's absolutely true that there is no inherent self in there somewhere. That's what realize emptiness means. When we have finally seen that and perfected that insight, then he says, it's as if there is no I. But there is an I. But what does exist is so subtle, it is as if it is an illusion. It is as if it doesn't exist, which is kind of tasty. Don't think it's some clever, kind of trippy, yogic statement. It's an actual description of reality for the person who has seen this truth. Okay, so if Buddha's saying whatever exists lacks inherent existence, forget inherent yet still, we first have to establish what exists. How do you even get your head around that right there? First, start with that one. And that itself was already fascinating. So when you study Buddhist philosophy, you learn that, you know, one of the first texts one studies is called Collected Topics, Dura in Tibetan. And you learn it when you're a little kid in the monastery, you know, and you learn it all. And it's the basis, it's all like the nuts and bolts of all the terminology and the structures that are going to be the basis of all your study until you finally led to the Madhyamika teachings, which is the middle way teachings, which is the emptiness teachings, where you can, when you can get all the stuff, where you can then go after 30 years and meditate and the penny will drop. The first one is you learn the different concepts that exist in the way Buddha's worldview. And so one of the first ones is you learn the terms for that which exists. And this is a totally central point for the Buddha. Remember, because we suffer because we're not in touch with that which exists, because we're completely believing in things that don't exist. This is Buddha's point. So we have to first establish how you establish what exists. So the really good framework for this is this marvelous teachings of the Buddha that Tsongkhapa, our patron saint, is he here? With his pointy yellow hat, is he around somewhere? He's up there somewhere, okay. You should point like that. Tibetans point this, they're very respectful. They point like that, they point like that. Like that. You notice, you'll see. So there's Tsongkhapa, he's our kind of patron saint. He's our Saint Francis. He's our lineage lama from the 14th century. And his trip, his expertise is this two truths. And this is the Buddha's essential teaching. So let's look at this in the context of this presentation. It's very tasty. Okay. The word truth in Buddhism is not meaning some absolute thing in the sky. It's simply meaning that it's referring to something that exists. So we've got conventional truths. We have ultimate truths or final. Or we have the way things exist conventionally and the way things exist ultimately. There's two truths, okay? Conventional and ultimate. So conventional, you've got to start with the conventional. So what that refers to, in the Buddhist view, is all the billions and trillions of different individual precise phenomena that the universes that we know of are made up of. And we can see every day we're creating new ones. I mean, you know, oh, my iPad's not here, but 10 years ago, who'd heard of an iPad? Nobody except Steve Jobs, you know, who invented the concept. He created it. And the Buddha's saying is, this is how everything in the universe comes into existence. We create them. We make them. Even the self. So, okay, look at what this means. So let's, you know, we've got to first establish, typical example, I always use this one, Mummy, what's a cup, darling? Mummy, what's a cup? So mummy won't just bully me into saying it. She will explain it to me. And what she'll first do is give me the definition. And you listen to this. A definition has two parts. The first part tells you its conventional characteristics, such that I can recognize it by looking in this case. She'll say, well, darling, it's that flat-bottomed clay container with a handle. So we have to deduce here, I know the meaning of a handle and flat-bottomed and clay and container. And if she has to, she'll have to define those for me first. And then I'll get the concepts around in my head, and then I'll be able to go, yes, I see it, mummy, but I'm not happy yet because I don't know what it does. I don't know its function. And this is a massive point for the Buddha. So, but mummy, what does it do? Well, sweetheart, it holds my tea. Now, she's told me that already, but I'm going to be clever and I'll say, mummy, would you please prove it to me? I'm not going to believe what you tell me. Kind of prove what you're saying, please. So she'll get the tea and she'll pick it up and she will pour it. And then I will observe that it holds my tea. So that means it fits the definition. So you tick all the boxes. But that's not quite enough, as the Dalai Lama said, you know, in the same philosophy, the Buddhist philosophy. I've got to then make sure that there are no other valid cognitions in the minds of other beings that contradict that. And once we've established that, we can all sign off on it. We all shake hands, and now we agree that's a cup. And we don't have wars, do we? When you say, that's a toilet, well, you could use it as a toilet if you like, if your bladder's not very full. You know, that's a knife, that's a plate, you know, that's God. You'd be in trouble, wouldn't you? But we're not, we don't have a problem. So we can have really fast sentences, really articulate, we can talk about music, mathematics. We're absolute incredible geniuses, are we not? We call it science. At putting together constructs of things that exist that we all buy into and accept. And then we can talk and create things. We're absolute geniuses at this. Buddha says that's how the universe exists. That our minds literally establish things. Okay, one of the many synonyms, there are several synonyms for that which exists. One of the first things you learn. The first one is phenomenon. It doesn't just refer to physical things. Anything that exists that you can establish like that and then is agreed upon. Conventional, by convention. That's why those lovely HSB, this is proving emptiness. You know those HSB ads, have you noticed? Those HSB ads. If you're in Asia, you keep your shoes on? No. If you're in America, keep your shoes on? Keep your shoes on? Yes. It proves emptiness. In one country, one thing is good. In another country, it's called bad. This is how everything is, Buddha says. Our minds call it that. We buy into that, and it becomes that. This is actually emptiness. We're already leaping to the end result here. Okay, so the various synonyms for that which exists. The term phenomenon, the term object or object of knowledge, knowledge meaning cognition, to know. Existent, the term itself, existent. Established base. These are terms, all synonyms for that which exists. And why Buddha's, like I say, so interested in this is because we're trying in this process, in the whole process of A to Z of being a Buddhist, you're doing two things. You're acting morally, you're trying to be good in order to see how things exist. Or you're trying to see how things exist in order to get happy. Whichever way you put it, it comes to the same thing. So, okay, we've established the terms. So the definition of an existent, each has a slightly different definition. The definition of an existent is that which can be cognized by mind. A valid cognition is a thought that is in sync with reality. So simple as that. That's what a valid cognition is. One that a thought and the thing that it refers to exists like that. Okay, Buddha's saying, without getting too complicated here, conventional truths are still a bit delusional. Because we're still, until we've realized emptiness, we don't really see the truth totally. But we'll, never mind that, we'll go into that more. But conventionally speaking, as Jeffrey Hopkins calls conventional truths, they're truths for a jerk. Because they're not quite true yet until you realize emptiness. There's still an aspect of delusion there. Oh, never mind, we'll go into this. So we first have to, before we go anywhere, we've got to first, about emptiness, we've got to first establish, because Buddha says, remember, whatever exists lacks inherent existence. So we got to it's implying you got to first establish a thing before you establish the emptiness of something on that thing. So it can never mean nihilism. In the Heart Sutra, Buddha says, what the Heart Sutra is, simply, is a listing of all the categories of phenomena according to the Buddhist view of the universe. The five aggregates, the four noble truths, the 12 links, the 18s, this, the something, that. That each of the groupings of phenomena in the universe are empty of existing inherently, like I just said. And it's a listing of those. And the way it's framed, as we know, the way it's spoken, as we know, he starts with the first of the five aggregates, which is the first category of phenomena, which is the category of phenomena that a person is said to be made up of. So we know this type of phenomenon is called a cup. This is called a thermos. This is called a saucer. That's a flower. That's a leaf. There's a tissue, you know. There's a couch. And this is a person. So in the simplest sense, conventionally, there's a person. So person, self, I, being, they're all synonymous. So conventionally, here is a self. Don't think, because we hear Buddha say, there is no self, that he's saying there's no self. It's more nuanced than that, okay? That's the point. That's the problem for us. Oh, there's no self. Chuck the baby out with the bathwater. Might as well kill myself. Not like that. So, okay, we've established there is a person. So one way Buddha taught in one of his sutras about what a person is made up of, and this is a major point when we begin to investigate the emptiness of something, it's we have to first establish the something, but then we have to establish that something, that every something, that everything is made up of bits and pieces. Okay? So the conventional truth is that, the shorthand for it is dependent arising. The shorthand for ultimate truth is emptiness. So the conventional truths exist like a cup, a toilet, a person, exist in dependence upon, in fact, countless factors. But there's one way of dividing into three levels. The first level at which a person or a cup, or a toilet, or a piece of caca, or God, or enlightenment, or hell, whatever is established as existing, it exists in dependence upon actually countless causes and conditions. That among any one of those causes and conditions, you will not find a self, a person, enlightenment, a thermos, hell. Because it's nothing other than the coming together of countless causes and conditions. Now the second one, which is the one we'll focus on, which is the tasty one, is that everything that exists, exists in dependence upon its parts, as they say, or all the bits and pieces. That whatever exists down to the millionth of an atom necessarily exists in dependence upon its parts. So, okay, this gets now intellectual, but one of the major arguments where Buddha diverged from the Hindus was exactly on this point. That the Hindus have come up with, and this is the same teaching in the Christian teachings, the Muslim teachings, about a soul. In the Buddhist, the Hindu teachings articulated as a permanent, meaning not changing from moment to moment, partless, not made up of bits and pieces, eternal, permanent, partless, a special, unique little extra thing that, if we're Catholics, Christians, it was given to us by God that determines that this is who I am. Or the Hindus call it very simply a self, Atma. And Buddha diverged from that point. Then the Buddhist views over the centuries have various interpretations of this. Even among the Buddhists, they interpret differently. That all Buddha's saying is, sorry, babies, there isn't such a thing existing. And this position of there being a permanent, partless, causeless phenomenon is also the same philosophical view of a creator. And Buddha says it's an unnecessary embellishment. It's like he's not saying there isn't a self. There is, but it doesn't exist like that, he says. He's not saying there does not exist, you know, infinite, wise, compassionate, omniscient consciousness. He says that's a Buddha and we can all become it. But he does not give it the job of being a creator. He says that's an extra embellishment. It's not an accurate truth. He would argue with it. So it's basically what Buddha's saying is there is something that does exist, but not in the way we think. It's not as if there is nothing, and it's not as if there is something, but there's this middle way between these, and it's not meant to be mystical, where there is a dependent arising self that does exist in dependence upon causes, conditions, and parts, etc., but not from its own side, not in and of itself, not inherently, not independent of this and that, not in and of itself, not intrinsically. And the bringing together of these two truths is the tricky part, you know. So the Heart Sutra says, in the first grouping of the categories of phenomena called the five aggregates, which is a way of presenting either the contents of the impermanent universe into five categories, or the contents of a person. And person, self, I, being, refer to any being, a dog, a hell being, a spirit. Remember, Buddha asserts all these different realms of existence, which we can talk about. A human. They're all sentient beings. And they're made up of these five bits. Some of the sentient beings are only made up of some of those bits. Okay, so the first one of those five bits is called form. And broadly, it's referring to the physical bits, okay? So that, as it says in the Heart Sutra, as we know, form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Form is nothing other than emptiness. Emptiness is nothing other than form. And then he goes on within it, and then he goes on, and then he says, within emptiness. This is the start, the first part of the sentence. Within emptiness, and then he lists, there is no form, feeling, this, that, this, 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 all the millions of things. Within emptiness, there is no. So, okay, to get our head around that, what he's saying is, technically, form is not emptiness, technically. But what he's meaning is, you can't have the emptiness of red anywhere other than on this white cup. Okay, emptiness of something. Okay, one more point. All right, okay. When we hear emptiness, we hear nothingness. We hear it, we can't help. We think nothingness. Mistake, mistake, mistake. It means lack. But like I said, with a cup, my cup is empty of tea. The room is empty of people. So you just don't say, oh, there is empty. Where, Rabina? Well, somewhere out there. That's completely demented. You've got to point to a thing that does exist, and then you see that it lacks something else. Can you hear that point? You can't have emptiness of tea in general, can you? It's absurd to say that. You've got to point somewhere to a specific thing and say, that thing lacks tea. That thing lacks red. Can you hear that? So that means so to say there is no I, it's absurd. You've got to say there is a self conventionally that lacks inherent existence. You've got to first point to a self that does exist. To find on that self the absence of inherent self. It's like anything. It's tricky words, but we're clever, we're brilliant, we're geniuses. We can learn millions of languages and abstract concepts will come out your ears, you know. So we can also learn this. So don't be lazy and think it's spiritual. You've got to sit there and close your eyes or cross your eyes or something, and close your legs and hope a vision comes, which is pathetic. It's like sitting at the piano, putting your hands on it and hoping Bach will channel through you. It's complete superstition. You've got to squeeze your brain, as Lama Yeshe says, for the penny to drop here. Are we communicating? So, okay, right back to the beginning. Buddha says the universe is made up of lots of things that do exist. So it's in this context that's really crucial to understand how the emptiness of something is a thing that exists. So do you accept that white exists on this cup? You do, don't you? And we can see, therefore, it's not red, can't we? So would you agree that the absence of red does exist on this cup? That's how you get your head around how emptiness is a phenomenon that does exist. The absence of something does exist. It seems abstract, but it's got immense meaning. And once you get this, you read all the teachings on emptiness and something will get deeper for you. Can you hear my point? So let's use examples of the emptinesses of things and how it's a vivid kind of real thing you can cognize. Let's say, what's her name again? Vanessa. No, what's her name? Natasha. Let's say Natasha's colorblind, and she every time she sees white, she sees red, like we talked. Okay, that mightn't be true, but let's just say. So what we know conventionally, this is called white, and it's going to make it easier for her if she can see the truth conventionally, because then she's going to communicate with people. Otherwise, she said to me, pass the red cup, and I say, I haven't got one. She'll think I'm lying. Then she'll sue me. There'll be big problems. You won't communicate, because words are really important. You with me? So we don't just bully her into believing it. It'll always make her stressed out. So we've got to help her see the truth, don't we? So we fix her eyes, obviously. Her eyes are clearly the problem, not her ears. Her eyes are obviously the problem. So we send her off to the, you know, optometrist somebody and get her fixed. Yeah? Can you imagine that? And now we'll bring her home and I'll show her the cup again. Now what will she see? Huh? Say it again. Who said that? Where are you? Okay, clever Shankar said it. Shankar's right, because he's heard me say it before. He might have realized it, but I think he's remembered it before. So what she will see, she will go, oh my God, it's not red. Won't she say that? Can you sort of hear my point? Why? She's addicted to seeing it as red. She expects red, she knows it's red, she waits for red, and she gets the shock of her life. Let me give you another really good example. Let's say you saved up your money. You've got 10,000 quid in the bank. And you know it's there. You believe it's there. You're thinking about it every day. You love your 10,000 pounds. You're so excited about your 10,000 pounds. You believe in your 10,000 pounds 100%. And you think you better go check in your account to look at your lovely 10,000 pounds again. And you open up the internet and you put your password in. You log in. You put your password in. You go to your statement. Listen to this. And there's a zero there. Now, believe me, you will not see a zero. What will you see? No. What will you see? No, come on, please. Please, you missed the point if you're saying all this. You're not getting it. What will you see? Thank you very much. Can you hear me? There's a zero there. There's a zero. But you won't see zero. Why? Because you so totally believed in the presence of 10,000 pounds. When we get this, we will be able to understand Buddha's teachings on emptiness. Please, you've got to hear me. Because what it's implying is for so long we have believed in a real inherent I. Again, don't worry what that means. But it's a mistake, Buddha says. It doesn't exist like that. But we believed in it for eons, he says. And the belief in this inherent I, or I'll express it a bit more now, the belief in an I that is independent of parts, independent of causes, independent even, most subtly, of the mind that makes it up. We believed in this big, fat, real, solid, pointable, findable, eternal, permanent, separate I-ness, a little mini-me in there who runs the body and the mind. We believe in that 1,000,000,000%. Do we not? And Buddha says, sorry, baby, that I does not exist. So seeing the truth of the absence of that I is a stupendous, stupendous paradigm shift in your mind. That's when you have the first direct, non-conceptual, genuine, instinctive, whatever you want, direct experience of the truth of that there has never been that I existing in here. Can you hear the words? So when you look in the bank, of course, if there's simply a zero there, if I looked in your bank for you, I say, no, darling, there's nothing in the bank. There's just a zero. There's nothing. I just see the truth, don't I? There's nothing. But you don't see the truth. You can't bear it. It's astonishing and shocking for you. You see the absence of a thing that you thought was there. Listen, if your hubby has left you for a younger version, every day in your house, all you see is the absence of Fred, isn't it? But if I don't know you had a husband, I'll walk in your house. I won't notice that there's no Fred, will I? Because I never expected Fred. This is the idea to get. You believe in something that you thought was there that isn't there. So the seeing of the isn't there is a shock to you. And of course, we're talking here. It's a marvelous experience to have when you do finally see the truth. And the truth is that there isn't that I. The truth isn't another I. The truth isn't something that you can kind of point to nice, tasty, delicious. The point is the absence of what you thought was there. That's what they mean by seeing emptiness. It's not seeing that there's nothing. Okay, we often think of emptiness as you've got dollars in the bank, pounds in the bank, and you chuck them all out. You say, oh, now there are no pounds. That's not the meaning of emptiness. Oh, there are no pounds in my bank. There's a big difference between, oh, there are no pounds in my bank, which is what you see if you just see zero. If I see zero, I'll just see nihilism. There are no pounds in your bank, dear. You won't see that. You will see the absence of 10,000 pounds, which is so much more vivid and shocking to you. Can you hear the difference between no pounds in your bank and the absence of 10,000 pounds? It's a massive difference. Can you hear it? So it does not mean, oh, well, you chuck all the bits out, there's no I. That's nihilism. You see the absence of what you thought was there. And Buddha says we've been thinking it since beginningless time. So it's quite a hard mistake to remove from our mind. But the way to get our head around this is how we've been talking yesterday. It's how you prepare your mind. When you learn Buddhist psychology in general, you learn about how the delusions function in exactly this way. They embellish what's there. So there is always something there. Okay, if you think there's a chocolate cake on your plate and there's fact nothing, you're in big trouble. That's a serious delusion, you know? Do you understand? But that's not. It's more nuanced than that, what's happening. There is a chocolate cake on your plate. You've got to admit that it is a chocolate cake. Or even if you think it's a carrot cake, you're in trouble. You label it correctly. There's a chocolate cake on your plate. But when attachment, like we said, which is the first voice of this ego grasping, the craving to get what that fantasy I wants, attachment, when that's running the show in your mind, when that's prevalent in your mind, when that's in the front of your mind, what that causes you to see is a divine, delicious, beautiful chocolate cake that will definitely make me happy. That's the definition of the chocolate cake attachment sees. But that's not the chocolate cake that exists there. Can you hear that point? Once we get this, we are on track with understanding how Buddha talks. It's incredible. But as Lamasova says, once we realize even emptiness, which, you know, okay, so let's say you hate chocolate cake. Well, what's prevalent in your mind is disgust or aversion. And when you see chocolate cake through the filter of your aversion, we all know it'll look disgusting and you want to go away from it. We all know that. It's normal. But if attachment's in your mind, it'll inform the cake, it'll inform you to make the cake look delicious and you'll run towards it and want to get in here. We know that. This is what we do all day, every day. This is normal samsaric behavior. We're driven by attachment, the default, and then when it doesn't get what it wants, the thing looks disgusting and horrible, and depending on how deep your attachment is how violent your aversion is. So that's why people kill or kill themselves, because attachment can't bear. Like John McEnroe said. What's he say? This can't be, what's he say? You can't be serious. That's attachment talking when it can't bear what it sees. That's what anger's saying. This is not possible. This can't be happening. Look at us when you go mad, you go completely crazy. It's like you're unable to even bear that terrible thing. That's attachment not getting what it wants. Because attachment's made up its own story. All the delusions make up their own story. They embellish, they exaggerate, they distort what is there. So we only think in our world that you're delusional if you think it's a carrot cake. We don't think you're delusional if you're attachment. We just think that's normal. Well, Buddha says it's a mental illness because you're not seeing the truth. And it's really hard to see how we're not seeing the truth. We can't see that we're not seeing the truth. We think, oh, look at that delicious chocolate cake, and everybody in the room is agreeing with you. We're all buying into the same lie. And then if a person doesn't like chocolate cake, we think they're stupid. You understand my point? Like if I'm a fanatic chocolate cake lover, I'm a fundamentalist. I'll put the non-chocolate cake lovers in prison, won't I? That's what we do, isn't it? Look at us. Our belief systems. You know? So it's hard to and this is where we're now being our own therapist, as I said yesterday, Lama Yeshe puts it. It's hard when you start to look into your mind to be your own therapist based upon single point of concentration or to whatever degree you've got concentration, where you step back and start to try to observe the contents of this mind of ours, this emotional soup that's raging on. We can't tell one bit from another. I like to call them all my roommates, okay? There's 47 variations of every one of them. 47 variations of attachment and anger and jealousy and this one, depression and low self-esteem, attached to being loved, attached to this, attached to that. And all the good ones are there too. The virtues are all there. But the neuroses, they run the show, unfortunately. They're out rampaging around the house. So poor old goodness and kindness and wisdom and clarity and love and compassion, they're kind of scaredy babies under the bed and in the cupboards. They don't come out. You kind of see what I'm saying. So we've got to start bringing them out to argue with the neuroses. They've got to come out and be brave, you know. That's what being your own therapist is. So the point I'm getting is that point, but the point is that these delusions, these neurotic emotions, are informed by misconceptions. And over the eons of time and over the lifetimes, we've built up this emotional package around these misconceptions. So we will never be able to change anger, depression, jealousy, low self-esteem until we've harnessed first the grosser level of the emotional explosions, which is when it gets to the physical and the mouth and the body. So that's why you've got to first control your body and speech. Live in vows, best. Harness your crazy energy. Then slowly giving you the space to do some focus, to look into the mind and start to make sense of all these roommates. Start to hear their stories. And then bring the virtuous, valid stories to argue with them. So it's quite a subtle job. It's quite a nuanced job, you know. Once we can do all that, then this leads us easily to how to get our head around the deepest lie of all, the one that informs all the others. So in other words, attachment exaggerates the deliciousness. But ignorance, maringpa, the root delusion, ego grasping, informs the attachment and causes us to think that the delicious cake exists out there from its own side, having nothing to do with me. That's the subtlest meaning, the one called merely labeled. This, the major way that everything seems to appear to us is out there kind of like attacking us, you know? Or chocolate cake, sitting there vibrating deliciousness, just like begging me to eat it. Like, poor me, what's it got to do with me? You understand my point? Okay, may I bring up that story, you know, that video about the Indian girl? India's daughter, what's it called? That lovely-looking, nice, handsome, young Indian man, you know, who was in prison. Do you understand the one I'm talking about? Who innocently, sweetly, naively stated his philosophy, which is prevalent, unfortunately, among him, obviously, and his people, some of them. That the chocolate cake, and hear my point, the chocolate cake's the blame. Can you hear my point here? Okay, we're getting a bit nervous when it's about women, but don't worry, it's the same thing. There's a girl out there, it's her fault. Well, that's the view in a mind, a certain kind of mind, that's called a male mind. It's delusions that blames the object of your attachment. Can you see what I'm saying? This is what we do every day. We blame the chocolate cake. That's why we can't resist it. Do you see what I'm saying? That's why we can't resist the chocolate cake. So he innocently said it. In America or in England, we'd be too, you know, politically savvy to say that. Our lawyer would tell you not to say that. But that's what he actually believes, because that's the view of attachment that puts it out there as existing out from its own side. This is the delusion the Buddha says we've all got. Can you hear me? I mean, every reason to have compassion for this poor man. Can you hear my point here? I remember when I was in London, I was a radical feminist. And I might have mentioned this, I can't remember. But when I was a radical feminist, I was always a sincere person. When I was a hippie, I had as much sex as possible. That's what you do, isn't it? With as many people as possible. Like, that's what I did, you know. Picked them up on the trailway, went hitching around Europe, slept with everybody. All the ones I didn't like, I sent them to go away, of course. I only slept with the nice ones. It was just what I did. I was a hippie. Then I was a kind of radical lefty, so I ran around bashing people and got arrested, and, you know, that's what you did. Then I was a feminist. Then, you know, you hate men. I was a serious feminist. I was a radical, lesbian, separatist feminist. I went all to the outerest. I went to the outer edge of being a feminist, okay? So one of my philosophies was, first, I could wear exactly what I liked, which included my beautiful breasts, and they were very nice when I was young. You know, showing if I wanted them to be through my shirt or whatever I liked. I didn't care. So I dressed as I wished, and if any man dared to open his mouth, which they did then, you'd be put in prison now. He expressed his typical wishes, you know. Then I'd go up to him and shout loud in the street and embarrass him completely, and I'd punch him or kick him or do something. And most poor men were really embarrassed, you know, isn't it? Well, there's two examples that were different. One was in North London somewhere. A lot of Greeks live there. Haringey. I lived in Haringey in a feminist squat, you know. So anyway, I was walking across the road and this tall bloke eating his fish and chips with glasses on, very tall. And he said something about my chest, you know. So I went up to him and I abused him. Well, he punched me. I punched him, that's right. And his fish and chips went flying. Well, he punched me back. It was the first one ever to punch me back. And I was quite respectful. I thought, wow, that's okay. My earring broke, my glasses broke. I wasn't upset at all, you know. I was quite respectful of him because most blokes were gobsmacked and just sat there looking embarrassed, you know. But one bloke in Soho, he burst into tears. And this is my point. He said, but if you don't want me to say anything, why do you look like that? That's the same as a chocolate cake. That's the same as that Indian guy. We blame the object. Okay, it's too emotional when we talk about rape. Because rape is not really sex, it's just violence, you know. Do you understand my point? It's just violence. We should get so confused about it. It's just plain violence. I mean, sticking a pipe up her poor vagina, can you imagine her entrails coming out? That's not sex, that's called violence. That's called hate. Simple. Don't get confused, you know. But it's blaming the object. That's what Buddha's saying. That's what it means, seeing it out there from its own side. That's what it means. Can you hear that? That's coming from the final mistake, the deepest mistake of being separate from it. I've got nothing to do with that. That's not my fault. I didn't ask to get born. Everything. So we walk through life with this panic-stricken fear. This view of existing out there is expressed in the view that your mother and father make you. I mean, this is the maddest idea I've ever heard. Of course it brings the panic and fear. Of course it brings hopelessness and victim. Of course it brings anger and blame. Of course it does. It's that philosophy. Can you hear that? This is all coming from this root delusion of believing in things as inherent. Which means, finally, the subtlest one of independent from first causes and conditions, then parts, but the most subtle, separate from my mind calling it that. Buddha's saying there's nothing that exists like that. We can see how we suffer. We come into this life full of fear because it's like being plonked in this nightmare by some other wretched person. I mean, how dare they, you know? Who the hell do I think my parents are making me, if that's the truth? I think it's the maddest idea ever. It's fascism. We all believe it like it's science. God almighty, I'd much rather have Buddha's view, please, any day. I'm trying to see if it's true, but at least intellectually I find it more appealing. I mean, there were so many contradictions if your mummy and daddy made you. I can't begin to go there. It's just mind-boggling. Anyway, never mind. But the point is, it brings the view of victim. This is why Lama Yeshe calls ego, self-pity me, poor me. It's all, you know, we think about it. That's what attachment and aversion are. It's the self-pity me. Greedily, because we're bottomless pits, wanting all the delicious things, assuming I deserve it. There's no logic to it. How dare? And then as soon as bad things come, you know, kick and scream and beat and murder and rape and kill. How dare you do that to me? I don't deserve it. That's anger talking. Attachment is this greedy vampire who wants to eat up the entire universe and still won't be satisfied. That's attachment. These are the philosophical expressions of the root delusion of ego grasping. Are we communicating? This is Buddha's view. So nothing exists out there from its own side. Of course, conventionally, there's a cake that you made. You know you did. You felt the chocolate. You put the eggs in. You did the oven. It's all there. But as Lama Zopa says, when you realize it's empty of inherent existence, it's empty of being not coming, it's empty of the mind labeling it, it's empty of being merely labeled. Sorry, it is merely labeled. Then it's as if there's no cake, as if there's no oven, as if there's no chocolate. It's like an illusion. And don't hear those lightly. It's a profound truth. And seeing that truth, you're blissful. As Lama Yeshe says, Milarepa's up in the mountains laughing. It's time for tea. For empty tea. But first, do you want some questions before we go? Any questions about this? Or you want to mull it over during tea? Mull it over during tea, okay? Try and stay focused and try and see how the tea is empty, how it's made by your mind. Try and do that, if you can. And the cream cakes and everything else. And I'll see you at noon.